This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Is the entire American healthcare system being corrupted by Big Pharma's endless search for the next blockbuster drug? Well, that's what author David Healy thinks, and whether or not you agree, the picture he paints isn't pretty.
Once we go over four or five drugs at any one point in time, we're at real risk of being injured or killed by effects that come from the combination of all these pills.
On today's Health Show, is American medicine on its way to Pharmageddon?
Then we'll hear a compelling commentary about suicide and the broken hearts and dreams it leaves in its wake. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. If you were to call the new book Pharmageddon a searing indictment of the pharmaceutical industry, you'd be right on point. Author David Healy has written a comprehensive and forceful argument against what he calls the pharmaceuticalization of medicine. Healy was the first to publicize the suicide-inducing side effects of many antidepressants. He attributes our current state of affairs to developments that have tied the survival of pharmaceutical companies to the development of blockbuster drugs, so that they must overhype benefits and deny real hazards. He recently spoke with The Health Show's Joe Donahue, who asked about the dire title of his book, Pharmageddon.
Well, that was one that was coined by a friend of mine called Charles Medawar, and he was trying to convey to people that what we've got is a world where it's a little bit like when you drive your car. Each trip you make in the car may be awfully useful and very, very helpful, and you may think to yourself, well, it's great to have a car, but we're slowly producing the kinds of conditions where climate change happens. We don't see that as a consequence of each of the trips we have in the automobile. In the same way, when we have encounters with the healthcare system, very few people see anything wrong when they go along to the hospital or doctor and have what appears to be a good encounter to them. But overall, we are pushing healthcare systems in a way that's not actually going to be sustainable for the future. We're producing climate change within healthcare, and the kind of medicine that we once had, where we took problems to doctors and our doctor helped us with the problem we had, is changing to one in which the healthcare system, for its own purposes, for its own health, takes problems to us and screens us for conditions that we don't have, and often puts us on treatments that we don't need. This isn't good for us, it isn't good for healthcare, and it's not good for the economy either.
I think that while I agree with you, I do think there's probably a number of people who would argue, myself included, I guess, that the possibilities and the chances of going in the hospital into that healthcare system and having everything go rosy and perfect, that those odds are getting lower and lower.
They are, yes. Unfortunately, I assume that both patients see when they go to the doctor, they see a doctor who hasn't got the time to listen to them and who often isn't looking at them even. He's looking or she's looking at the computer screen where the results of the latest measurements feature. And people who run the healthcare system even are under the impression that all medical care is about is putting the numbers right, and you don't even have to see the same doctor from visit to visit, because anyone can look at the computer screen and see what the results are and prescribe the pill that's the answer to any measurements that appear to be a problem. So there's been a real degradation in healthcare, but it's crept up on us very slowly, so that people often they're aware that things aren't quite right. They're aware that things weren't the way they used to be, but there often isn't a change from one visit to the next where they see so clear-cut a change that they're able to put a finger on just what's happening.
So I look at my father, who is 85 years old and in relative good health now, although he certainly had his shares and his ups and downs. And, you know, he'll go in and there will be a concern over his heart, and there'll be concern over his lungs and of pneumonia in the past, and his eyes. And, you know, there is a degradation of the body, the natural aging process. And you talk about creeping up, but all of a sudden you realize that the man is on between 20 and 30 prescription drugs. And you think to yourself, God, well, it presents two problems. First of all, your issue, which is the medicine itself and what it's actually doing, but also for the family and for the patient of someone who is overseeing all of that to see that pill A doesn't deal with pill B to deal with pill C, because it used to be the day where you would trust the pharmacist, but now you're getting the drugs from eight different places anyway.
Absolutely. And again, you've gone to the heart of the issue here, which is that companies have been very adept at getting doctors, our patients, to measure things. And the measurement produces a problem that a pill will often be the answer for. And what they've also done is they've had control of the clinical trials that bring drugs on the market. Now, we introduced clinical trials as a means to try and rein in the pharmaceutical companies. And the next thing we did was to say that, well, if there are all these clinical trials done, we should be able to write guidelines as to what the best treatment is. Trouble is, industry have control of the trials. They only publish the trials that suit them. And in a sense, even though the guidelines are written by people who are completely independent, industry effectively control the guidelines also. And there's a guideline for hypertension, and a guideline for asthma, and a guideline for gut problems, and nerve problems, and heart problems, and every conceivable problem. And it's quite possible that a person like your father may get the best care in the sense that everybody looking after his heart and his eyes and his chest and his gut are following guidelines. They're doing the best possible thing according to the evidence. The trouble is, guidelines for illnesses suit industry. What we need are guidelines for people. One of the key points on which would be that once we go over four or five drugs at any one point in time, we're at real risk of being injured or killed by effects that come from the combination of all these pills. We're at a point where treatment-induced death and disability is said the fourth leading cause of death, and there are probably areas within healthcare in which it's the leading cause of death.
You use a figure in the book, which is really stunning, of the global market for pharmaceuticals is $900 billion. You also make the point that apart from cancer drugs, that few new drugs actually target disease. They are instead lifestyle or risk management drugs, or things that we take for antidepressants or for our cholesterol or for our blood sugar or for acid reflux or osteoporosis or sexual dysfunction. They are drugs that are not focused specifically, in most cases, on disease.
Absolutely correct. And what we've got here is a world where until 30 to 40 years ago, industry made their money out of producing pills that cured an illness. Pills that meant that we didn't die, or that we got out of bed, cured, and were able to go back to work. One of the other quick points for us to make about the former kind of treatment is when you treat a disease, you treat to the point where the person's cured, and after that they stop the pill. But right. These weren't the treatments that actually suited the industry the best. They weren't the best for the health of the pharmaceutical companies. What was much better for them was the idea of treating risk factors. And for every one person who has a serious illness, there's going to be at least 10 and maybe up to 100 who have a risk factor for an illness. Where you treat an illness until it's cured, you potentially treat risk factors forever. Where very few people have more than one illness at a time, you can have lots of risk factors at the same time. And it would be fine if treating risk factors like this really did make us feel better and better able to work. But in fact, often what you're doing when you're treating a risk factor is you're treating a person who isn't ill, who actually feels quite well. And you put them on a treatment that can often make them feel very unwell. Drugs like the drugs we take to lower our blood cholesterol levels can leave you with severe muscular aches and pains, can leave you with problems with your memory and a range of other things, which means that you or I wouldn't be able to work as well as we're able to work normally. So rather than getting us back to work, these are pills that will often mean that people who were at work aren't able to work as well as they have been doing, and they're off work. And at the same time, where before we had been handing over a large amount of money, but we gained from it, now we're handing over even more money, but ending up less able to do the kinds of things that we'd hoped that this money would buy us.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with David Healy, the author of Farmageddon, continues with a look at how much of this problem is our own fault. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1262.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. Our guest today is David Healy, author of the book Farmageddon. He's speaking with The Health Show's Joe Donahue.
How much of this is on us in the sense of when we go to the doctor and we're not feeling well and we go to an urgent care or to our general practitioner, our GP, and we go in? It seems that now I'm not a big lover of taking pills, and I don't like that. However, you do feel you feel somewhat cheated if you go in sick and you don't come out with a prescription for something.
That's correct, and I think the problem. It's interesting that you say how much is of this problem is on us. I think it isn't really on us, but it's on doctors. I think often these are the people who've failed us. Now, I make this point as a doctor who prescribes drugs. Part of the problem is, you see, these drugs are available on prescription only. And this means that, you know, when they're brought on the market first, we have every reason to think that these drugs are going to be riskier than alcohol or nicotine or cocaine or Valium or stimulants or drugs like these. But in fact, a curious combination of things happens. Because doctors, you see, are the true consumers. When you say us, the consumers of the pills are really doctors. And they consume by putting the pill in you and me. And they don't realize that they're the focus of the greatest marketing power on earth. Where companies like Apple and Microsoft and General Motors have huge marketing budgets, they're dwarfed by the marketing budgets of the pharmaceutical companies. And General Motors market to all of us. The pharmaceutical companies just market to doctors, and they understand doctors better than doctors understand themselves.
So
and
you
they're able to generate great pressure on the doctor to make sure that we consume.
I apologize for interrupting. It's just our time is running short. But you watch the nightly news. Any network news in the States, and I would say anywhere between 50 and 70% of those ads are for pharmaceutical drugs. Now,
yep.
So are you saying that those are being marketed to just doctors? Because they certainly seem
yes.
like they're being marketed to patients.
No, I know. But what's actually happening here is that that the ads to you and me are aimed at getting us to put even more pressure on the doctor.
Well, sure.
Than all of that. I mean, first of all, there's more marketing budget goes into the doctor than does into the ads to us. But the ads to us aren't really ones where we can actually dictate what we get. They're aimed at getting us to put even more pressure on the doctor, who's the true consumer. And the interesting thing about it is the doctor consumes by putting the pill into you and me so that he has no problems at all when things go wrong. It's unlike a pilot. If you fly from the West Coast to the East Coast, your safety is of ultimate concern to the pilot, because if the plane goes down and you go down, she goes down too. But in the case of a prescription-only drug, if you go down, the doctor doesn't go down. What we need to try and do is re-engineer a world where doctors are as concerned about our safety as pilots are.
And obviously how much they trust the pharmaceutical companies themselves and the products that they are selling. Because sometimes, I mean, and to be fair, an individual doctor may not have made that decision, but a practice has made a decision, or a hospital has made a decision of a certain medicine that will be used.
That's true. And what they don't realize, and again, where they perhaps fail us, as opposed to us being the people who are actually responsible, is that
right.
They've failed to realize that companies only publish about half of the trials they do. And of the trials that are published, close to 100% are ghost-written, and sometimes to the point where the ghostwriters have taken an essentially negative study of the drug and transformed it into a rosy, positive publication appearing in one of the best journals in the field. And this is what leads the practice or the university hospital to say, well, we'll put this new drug on the formulary. But, you know, we need to be much more aware of how industry has been able to engineer us into picking the drug that suits them.
Again, the name of David Healy's book is Pharmageddon. It's published by the University of California Press. He spoke with the Health Show's Joe Donahue.
Suicide takes the lives of nearly 30,000 Americans each year, and today's suicide rates are the highest they've been in over a decade. Today, commentator Rachel Marlin tells us how suicide impacted her family.
It's a beautiful fall day. Leaves are just beginning to make their descent to the ground for the upcoming winter. I spot my family huddled around a bulletin board, talking quietly with each other. As I make my way towards them, the dead leaves beneath my feet crunch. When I come closer to the bulletin board, I make out pictures of different people, most of them young, some old. As I scan the board, I come across a collage of my granddad, a picture of him on his beloved boat on one of our vacations to the Outer Banks, even him with his all-time favorite dog, Rascal. I hear soft sobs and turn to see my sister, mom, and aunt wiping tears from their cheeks. My sister quietly lets out the words, "I really miss him." My family is at the annual Out of the Darkness Community Walk to benefit the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, or AFSP. Ever since my granddad's suicide in 2006, my family comes together each fall to walk in his honor. We are surrounded by thousands of others who have been personally affected by suicide, as well as those who just walk for the cause. With all of us together, wearing t-shirts with the words Team Jack printed across the front, it brings me back to the day that changed our lives forever. I remember this life-changing day like it was yesterday. I was a junior in high school, 16 years old, and in that stage where I actually tried to look nice for school. It was around 6:45 in the morning on a cold December day. Not a cloud was in the sky, and the sun was shining bright. It's funny how such a beautiful, sunny day can become one of the worst days of your life. I still remember the jeans I was wearing and the bright blue three-quarter sleeved shirt that was probably too tight for how old I was. I was in the process of applying mascara, which I had recently discovered, along with all other sorts of makeup. I heard a knock on my bedroom door. Figuring it was my mom telling me to hurry up for school, I called out that I was almost ready. But when I heard a second knock, I knew it was more important than just being on time for school. Mascara wand still in hand, I made my way to the door. But when I opened it, I instantly knew something was wrong. Standing in front of me was both my mom and dad, which was weird because my dad rarely came down to my end of the hallway. Before I could say anything, my mom spoke up, tears in her eyes, and said, "Granddaddy died, so we're going to go to Grandma's house today and see everybody." Before I even realized what I was doing, I was suddenly in my mom's arms, tears streaming down my face, with my dad's hand gently rubbing my back. At the time, it never occurred to me that my granddad wasn't sick or anywhere near dying. I had seen him just a few days prior to celebrate his 77th birthday. At the time, it never occurred to me that his death can be contributed to anything but old age. The hour car ride to my grandma's house was the worst. The majority of the ride was quiet, my dad driving, and my mom softly crying in the front seat. I was in the back seat with my sister, whose sobs were so loud she had trouble breathing. I spent the ride staring out the window, quietly crying, thinking this all must be a mistake, or even a dream. It was when my mom spoke up through the sad silence when everything changed. She turned to my sister and I as she said quietly, "The good thing is, he didn't do it in the house. He drove away from home, so Grandma didn't have to be the one to find him." I was confused. I didn't understand what she meant about him leaving the house. When my sister started to put the pieces together, and the horror crossed her flushed face, my mom spoke up again. "Girls, Granddaddy took his own life." The wail that came out of my sister's mouth was unforgettable. Where she took the emotional sobbing role, I took the quiet and completely stunned role. It's the moments following my mom's statement when I can't quite remember what happened. I don't remember if I said anything or what the rest of my family said. All I remember is never having been so shocked in my life. I was still young, living in my carefree bubble of a life, knowing almost nothing about suicide or anyone who ever experienced it. Despite the tragedy, my grandma was unbelievably brave. She spent more time focused on the rest of my grieving family when all we wanted was to see how she was holding up. It was after my granddad's death that I truly saw where my mother's strength, as well as the rest of my family's, comes from. I'm blessed to be part of such an amazing and strong family. Not long after the funeral, my mom was downstairs in the study room late at night and had probably figured everyone was asleep. I had never seen my mom truly break down until this moment. I could hear her crying from upstairs, and figuring she'd want her privacy, I quietly snuck downstairs to check on her. What I saw broke my heart. My mom was sobbing, with her head in her hands, completely slumped over her desk. I ran over to her and wrapped myself around her as we cried holding each other. Seeing my mother this distraught was one of the hardest things I've ever had to witness. It's been over 5 years since my granddad's suicide. Despite how long it's been, I'll never forget that day. I'll never forget the last time I saw him at my aunt's house. I'll never forget that same cologne he always wore. And when I smell that cologne on someone else, I inhale it deeply, wishing my granddad was beside me instead. I'll never forget his love of animals, his unimaginable intelligence about almost everything, and his completely stubborn attitude. And I'll never forget the feeling of complete shock and heartbreak upon hearing the news of his death. Death is hard no matter what, but in my opinion, it's even harder to face when a loved one chooses to end their life. You're always thinking about what you could have done to prevent it from happening, and always wondering why they left you. But what I've learned from personally experiencing this kind of tragedy is that it's not your fault. Don't blame yourself for something you couldn't have prevented. But what you can do, for everyone out there, whether or not you've personally experienced suicide, is pay attention to warning signs. If your loved one is acting out of the ordinary, if they seem lost or depressed, or want to spend more time alone than with others, don't ignore these signs. It could be nothing, or it could be the beginning signs of suicidal thoughts. Whatever it may be, talk to them and make sure that they are in fact okay. And for those of you out there who have lost a loved one to suicide, or if you are having suicidal thoughts, you're not alone. Join groups like the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. You'll be surrounded by loving, caring people who know exactly what you're going through. Before my granddad's death, I never thought twice about suicide. But now I know how important it is to educate others about this increasingly common tragedy. And what I've learned from his death is to always let the people you love know how much you care about them. I would do anything to have a simple conversation with my granddad again, one that I completely took for granted before. We'll always be missing you, Granddaddy.
Rachel Marlin is a senior communications major at Western New England University in Springfield, Massachusetts.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.